Hi, everyone. It's Mark Bittman, and welcome to Food. As always, you can reach us at food@markbittman.com, and feel free to do that. We do respond, and we will also answer questions on air. So any questions you have about cooking or anything else food, let us know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
You're about to listen to an interview that really made me giddy with excitement. If you're into farming, social justice, land reform, this is a no-brainer for you. But I can't imagine anyone not finding the awesome people I talked with here anything short of fascinating. You will hear four voices. Me, you may know my friend Liz Carlisle, who's an assistant professor in the Environmental Studies program at UC Santa Barbara, where she teaches courses on food and farming. Liz's new book, which is a collaborative effort, it's called Healing Grounds, Climate Justice and the Deep Roots of Regenerative Farming. In it, she shares the stories of five people of color who are reviving their ancestors' methods of growing food, reclaiming their community's ancestral knowledge and relationship to land, and sequestering carbon in the soil to address climate change. Two of these inspiring people are joining us today. They are Mai Nguyen and Latrice Tatsi. Farmer Mai, as they're known, is a true social justice activist, and part of their work includes applying their background in climate research and Buddhist farming to cultivate regionally adapted heritage grains and Vietnamese seed crops. We will talk with Mai about all of that. Latrice is an ecologist and advocate for tribally directed bison restoration. She remains active in her family's cattle ranching operation at Blackfeet Nation in Northwest Montana. That's enough intro. We have a lot of material here, and it is really great, so let's get right to it. I'll just start by saying that the book that we're talking about here, which is Healing Grounds, Climate Justice and the Deep Roots of Regenerative Farming, which Liz coordinated or wrote, I'm not sure what you say, with five other people, and we'll get to that, of course. And then Liz, it's such a big topic that it's hard to we'll just touch on a few things, but Liz has done a great job of organizing and giving overviews to this material, but bring depth to the subjects of agroecology, climate change, soil health, agriculture in general, but also to the land of North America and from its time as a productive, stable, functioning agricultural system that served people and animals and even land and the rest of the biosphere to where we are now, which is a place where most agriculture produces food for profit while the land and the environment in general suffer, and where, in addition, too many people go hungry or suffer from other forms of malnutrition, and where biodiversity is at its lowest point ever. All right, enough. So, sorry, but, you know, with this subject, it's hard to just say, hey, guys, Liz, I guess I'll start with you. You're, again, coordinating a book about regenerative farming, which is we'll talk about that term, but in general, it's a movement happening in farming in which farmers are not only farming in a principled and respectful manner, but trying to reconnect with their roots to fight climate change. And you tell or help tell the stories of five women of color who are reviving, rejuvenating their ancestors' methods of growing food. So as I mentioned, we have Maya and Latrice here with us today. But before we go too deep, maybe Liz, you can give us a little brief primer on regenerative farming, what it means and why it's so important. I promise I'll talk less for the rest of the... That was a lot.
It's a big topic. And thank you so much for inviting us, Mark. Yeah, so I've been really excited about this idea of regenerative agriculture ever since I first heard the term. And I think even since before I first heard that particular term, but I've been really concerned for a long time about the degree to which agriculture contributes to climate change. The estimates range from, you know, a quarter to a third of global greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture as it's currently practiced. And at the same time, I've been really excited about the idea that we could shift agriculture from a climate problem to a climate solution. And that because in agriculture, we partner with plants, you know, those plants can draw carbon dioxide down from the atmosphere and replace it in the soil so that all of those hundreds of years of, you know, plowing and releasing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, well, that could all be healed in a sense through regenerative agriculture. That's the promise that got me really excited about it when I started writing and researching regenerative agriculture about 12 years ago. But in this book, I think what I recognized is that the extractive logic that you know, removed all that carbon from the soil and into the atmosphere, that was part of larger processes of colonization. And so that's really what we have to heal. A truly regenerative agriculture goes back to those root causes of colonization. And we need to look to the leadership of indigenous communities and communities of color that not only originated these practices of regenerative agriculture, you know, hundreds, thousands of years ago in their own communities, but also have been honing them as strategies of survival and resistance in the face of the very extractive agriculture that those communities are on the front lines of. And so as I, you know, spoke to more and more folks from these communities who had these visions of regenerative agriculture as truly healing, as truly reparative, I got more and more excited about what a powerful climate solution this could be, but also the synergy between a climate solution and a path towards racial justice in the food and agriculture sector.
Is what we're talking about regenerative agriculture, or are we talking about something bigger? I mean, I know we're all always grappling with terms, but when you start to talk about social justice, are we still talking about regenerative agriculture? And this, any of you can answer this, obviously.
I'll just jump in and say, yes, absolutely. I think that we are. And that regenerative agriculture, in order to achieve its goals of moving the needle on climate change, needs to engage with racial justice and land justice. So I think, yes, we're talking about regenerative agriculture. We're talking about how to sequester carbon in soil through agricultural methods that really center soil health. And in order for that to happen, that needs to be part of larger social processes as well. We can't imagine that these technical changes will be achieved on their own without being part of a larger set of social changes.
I'm with you there. I know that some people are concerned about the co-opting of the term regenerative agriculture because it's easygoing sounding. It's everybody, how can you not be in favor of regenerative? But I think if my goal were to say, I'd like listeners to this podcast to turn this thing off and say, or to finish this thing and say, regenerative agriculture, sustainable agriculture, whatever, you can't just throw these terms around without thinking about how you get to the place where farming is healthy. It's fine to say, or it's easy to say, yes, we want healthy farming. We don't want farming to contribute to climate change. I'm not saying it's easy to do it, but it's easy to say it. It's important for us to stress that it's not easy to come by, that this isn't easy to come by, because there are all of these social and racial justice issues attached to land. Because when we talk about farming, we're talking about land. So that's not really a question, but I bet one or more of you could comment on it.
Yeah, I think you're pointing to, you know, how regenerative is a contested term, right? That there's it's a hopeful term, right? That I think captures this feeling that people have in terms of the dissatisfaction around the interventions so far in agriculture to try to make it more sustainable and just. And so with the disillusionment perhaps around organic and sort of how far that's gotten us, that we still only have 2% of U.S. farmland as certified organic, that we're not seeing the social and environmental impacts that we had sort of hinged onto that movement, you know, that there's now a discussion about regenerative. And I really want to have listeners, yeah, focus on sort of the forms of suffering that you had sort of outlined at the beginning, and thinking about how we address those forms of suffering. And it may not neatly fit under the term regenerative because, and you know, you might, a listener might look up that term and see like, oh, General Mills is putting out a regenerative certification, you know, like a platform. And that doesn't necessarily match up with what permaculturalists are saying are regenerative, or what indigenous activists are saying are regenerative, right? There's so many definitions of that term, but I think if we go back to sort of the root causes that also Liz was talking about, the forms of suffering that isn't just environmental, but it is social, that is connected to colonialism, right, and forms of oppression. From there, that's when we talk about what we want to regenerate. It's regenerating diverse ecosystems and cultures that it necessarily has to involve repair and restoration, right? Otherwise, we're just regenerating what we have now, which is a degraded form of the things that have resulted from the forms of violence and dispossession that have already happened, right? So we need to do this repair work, and that reparations, right, is a social justice matter. And so does that fit under the term regenerative? You know, possibly, and listeners can, and hopefully will become participants in trying to come up with a more clear and cohesive and unifying, you know, definition of regenerative. But we also don't want people to like lose sight of the purpose of, you know, what regenerative is trying to do, right? Through jargony terms and, you know, trying to keep up with the most recent hashtag, but really to stay focused on what are the forms of suffering that we are trying to ameliorate? How do we do that together?
In a way, we're talking about regenerating, repairing our relationship to the land. And when you say repair, in the same root as reparations, and I think that if you take all of that together, I think you kind of get close to what we're talking about here. Latrice, I want to ask you specifically about some of the work you're doing. You're a soil ecologist and cattle producer and a member of the Blackfeet Nation, obviously, and you're also an advocate for tribally directed bison restoration. That's regenerative stuff. We're talking about an effort to restore buffalo to their historical range. Can you just talk about that for a little bit in the context that we're living in right now?
In the terms of, you know, regenerative agriculture and you know, bringing back the bison, you know, after the introduction of more agrarian practices of bringing cattle to, you know, our historical territories. And, you know, now we've adapted with those changes, but now, you know, bringing back the tribal herd in management and bringing them back to their traditional home and to their territory, and understanding what that relationship is that they have with the land, because whether we're talking about plants or whether we're talking about animals, we have to look too at the evolution of, you know, the relationship that they have. And so, you know, for my work and what I'm particularly interested is, what is the relationship that the bison have to the land? And really, you know, watch that, because you know we're not going to go back to historical times of where every animal was able to roam freely and we had like diverse gardens. You know, native cultures had the diversity in how they were growing their foods. But the you know, the idea is to make those implementations and changes where we can, and that's a big part of my work, is taking what we've had through our cultural knowledge and our cultural sciences and looking through that lens of how our people held that relationship with the land. You know, when for me, when we speak on regenerative grazing or regenerative, and you know what Liz and everybody was talking about, it's also revitalizing that relationship. And I think that's really key, because as humans, we tend to take ourselves out of, you know, the equation that we're equal to animals and that we're all a part of this, these ecological processes. And when we do that, then I think that's where we get into trouble in mismanaging resources. And so in our stories, in our cultures, we always learned from the animals. The animals took pity on us and showed us how to live on the land. And so for me, and the way that I look at the research that I'm doing, is I'm just learning the ways of the relationship the animals have to the land, while also looking into, you know, bringing a sustainable food back to the Blackfeet Nation, and you know, in that implementation and those changes that are already coming. But also, you know, the land feeds us, the soil has to be healthy for the plants to be healthy, and then the animals are for us to consume. So it's that reciprocal relationship that I really see as value when we talk about regenerative ag, because not only regenerative relationships, but we're also, you know, regenerating this knowledge of people of color in different cultures, that it, you know, was the way that they maintain their livelihoods. And so, you know, in the bigger lens and the broader lens, that's how I really look at it. And having these conversations are important, because, you know, we can't all speak to everybody on an individual basis, but when we have opportunities to be on these podcasts, we can share our outlook. And that's really important, because we are people of stories, and how we share information, it's oral traditions. And so being able to carry that on and share our knowledge through, you know, this new age of, you know, technology, it makes it nice, because we're just throwing stones and creating ripples. And as you throw bigger stones, you get bigger ripples, and, you know, it creates these changes. And, you know, we're at the start of it, because when you have, you know, these Eurocentric values come in, it was only a one-way process, and, you know, that's just the way things went about it. And now we're kind of in trouble because, you know, that dominated. But now we're coming back to look at all the cultures that lived on these landscapes, not just in the United States, but around the world, and really valuing what those relationships are, to learn how to balance out what we take and what we receive and take, you know what I mean? And those relationships of bringing in balance. So that's kind of my view on it.
The answer of throwing rocks and creating ripples is like, just killed me. It'd be such a appropriate thing to say sometimes. It's just like, I don't know exactly, but here's the conversation we're having now, and we're spreading some words and making some noise, and that's important also. I also think that there's a sort of, I don't know if it's Eurocentric or human, but this notion that we live such short lives, relatively speaking, and if we don't have an oral tradition, then it's hard to see the past. And so many people in the world have been separated from their pasts through forced migration or through genocide or any number of things, that it's hard to, I'll just say personally, it's hard sometimes for me to remember that there is this 10,000 years at least, or more, depending on how you look at it, of accumulated wisdom of people living on the land. And I have zero wisdom of people living on the land. So it's just worth remembering. Latrice, one other question I wanted to ask you was the relationship between bison or buffalo and the land, and how that relates to climate change, how we might use that to look at climate change.
In the perspective that I look at it, Mark, it's a relationship in how they graze, because people could say, oh my goodness, like, cattle grazing or, you know, bison grazing in general is you know, causing carbon to be released into the atmosphere and not put back. But when you look at grazing practices of bison, of where they'll graze an area and they'll let it rest for, you know, longer periods of time. And so when I started to do work with these nonprofit organizations on the Blackfeet Nation, it was really taking that approach and applying it to cattle ranch operations, because it's looking back in the past to make it applicable to today and knowing that if we graze it, but we let it rest, those plants are going to come back and they're going to be able to take more carbon out of the atmosphere, you know, and make carbohydrates in the soil. The micro, you know, the organisms are going to, you know, use what they can and then kind of have a little burp or whatever and then release a little. But for the, you know, a large part, it's really about having that those plants root it back in to the soil, but looking at it in that rest period. And so for me, that's really what it's about, is, you know, using grazing as a tool and using buffalo or bison as a tool and how to have better management practices so that, you know, that relationship of the carbon sink in the soil and the grazing can be integrated back in a more positive context instead of everybody pointing fingers, oh, it's them, it's them. It's like, no, you got to find a balance and you have to understand that we kind of mess that up and it's about relearning that. And so for me, it's always that process of just looking at it through their behavior and trying to understand it through a more scientific background, but also through the cultural science background of, you know, why their behavior was so important, not just for, you know, the survival of our my people or, you know, other Indigenous people in general, but, you know, how those ecological relationships benefited, you know, what we call Mother Earth in the bigger sense.
Thank you for that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Maya, I did want to ask you about Buddhist farming, which I know nothing about, and I'm sure most of the people listening here know nothing about either, and you've been involved in. So maybe you could just tell us a little about what that means.
Yeah, sure. Well, so Buddhism basics, there's the concept of the Four Noble Truths, the Four Noble Truths being that there is suffering, that there is a cause of suffering, there is an end to suffering, and the way out is through the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path involves...
Here we are, Buddhism 101. I love it.
Yeah, is there a crossover podcast?
I'm sure. We can find somebody.
But the Eightfold Path involves, you know, right thought, right action, right speech. There's eight of them. You can continue from there. And so how that influences my farming is, well, I mean, I think going back again to sort of how you opened up this podcast, right? Thinking about the kinds of suffering related to agriculture. You know, you mentioned the suffering in relation to, you know, diet-related illnesses, food, you know, hunger, and those access issues. And so, you know, in my farming, thinking about that, I grow Vietnamese crops as seed and heirloom varieties of grain. And I specifically grow these older varieties of wheat, for example, that weren't selected out so that they had this outsized endosperm, right? The way that modern wheat has been bred, so that it could be sifted into your refined flour that has caused diabetes and all kinds of diet-related illnesses, heart diseases, right? That you've also, I think, delved into a bit. And so I grow these varieties that can be eaten as whole grains and, you know, have the, you know, fiber and all the nutrients intact. So thinking about the cause of suffering in relation to this colonization process of refining wheat so that we could export it everywhere and, you know, dominate other economies and erode food sovereignty in all these other places in the world, right? So addressing that form of suffering through growing these varieties of wheat and also explicitly working with millers who keep the grain intact as whole wheat and mill them in stone ground form, which I will not get into. I'm sure you already have a podcast on.
Yeah, it's a conversation I'd love to have, but maybe another time.
Right. But so that's sort of on the, you know, on the sort of seed selection and trying to get these non-patented varieties of wheat that are old for those, you know, dietary reasons, but also for climate adaptation reasons, right? So we know that, well, Liz talked about the forms of climate-related suffering that has been induced by agriculture, right? The release of greenhouse gases, for example, and the varieties that I grow capture 5 to 6 times more carbon than other kinds of grains. And so, you know, I explicitly chose them to do that carbon capture of atmospheric carbon and also, you know, have adapted them to the California climate, which, as many people know, we've been experiencing drought for a long time, wildfires, you know, flash storms after these periods of drought. And so how do we ensure that we don't experience these forms of suffering of, you know, food insecurity by having these climate adapted grains? And so, you know, that's really informed, again, how I choose my seeds, but also how they relate to my farming practices of dry farming, rotations with animals, no petrochemical uses, and intercropping, just to name a few.
Right. Would you equate regenerative farming and Buddhist farming, or can you say what the relationship between the two is or the differences are?
Well, okay, so I think I'll just be honest about my views of regenerative farming, which is that it's a term that makes me roll my eyes. It's like a pretty instantaneous reaction, just because it's been so, it's the hot term, and I've been in so many conversations too, where there's a great deal of gatekeeping and grandstanding of like people who said, like, I wrote the book on regenerative, there's no other definition, and, you know, but also looking at regenerative, and like I said earlier, sort of there's these different definitions espoused by different groups of people. And overall, what I see in terms of the ones that have really risen to the top in popularity, it's like the practices kind of have this like dim sum approach to taking practices that have already existed in other parts of the world and other cultures. So to that extent, yes, I see overlap in the sense of, you know, like having perennials that have plants with deep root structures and that can be pollinators, and that pollination and the recognition of the sort of longer time scale, our connectedness deep into the ground as well with other beings, you know, that is something that is also within the Buddhist perspective of interconnectedness. So I do see those forms of overlap, but I think what's helpful for me in terms of exercising my Buddhist upbringing in farming is thinking not just about the what we do, right? Regenerative, especially as it moves towards, you know, how can you check off this criteria to say that you're regenerative, right? It's very focused on particular outcomes, but through a perspective such as that of Buddhism, is also thinking about how we get there and the relationships that we have, right, through right speech, right action, and all of that, that those relationships are also key to an ecosystem, a dynamic one, right? That compassion, the like action of compassion is key to then understanding how you will interact with those pollinators, how you'll interact with other animals that may come to the land in, for, you know, my instance is the case of wildfires where habitats are being destroyed, and without a sense of compassion, you know, I'd be like, all right, this farm is mine. You are not coming out here, not eat my crops. But recognizing that, yeah, we are connected and that those animals are in flight and in need, and yeah, will take a toll on my crop, that's a part of a worldview of ecology that I don't see in regenerative.
Maybe there's a message in there that the definition's elusive because it shifts from place to place and practice to practice, that farmers are best off if they understand their land and what it needs and what it can do. And that's going to change. I mean, you're talking about California. It's obviously a lot different from New England or Europe or Africa or Asia or anywhere. So.
Right. So maybe if we had like a lowercase r regenerative to just kind of like connect all these people who are, yeah, just trying to, yeah, farm in a way that's, or be and be land stewards in a way that is more ecological,
good,
designed for interconnectedness. I'm cool with that. But I think once we lean towards that like capital R, let's brand it, you know, put it in Whole Foods, and the way that it becomes exclusive, it, like you said, it doesn't really account for the necessary regional adaptations that are very important in a dynamic world, but also with climate change.
I wonder if that's part of the, and I do not at all want to get into this because it would take an hour, but I wonder if that's part of the argument for using the word agroecology, which is that it's a very hard word to co-opt because you can't even, you don't even know what it is. So it doesn't really mean anything until you start explaining it. Anyway, let's not go there. Liz, I know you had some issues about doing this book, about doing it yourself. I think you've done an amazing job in bringing in other voices that are important and complementary and really wonderful. We're seeing that here now. I wonder what you learned in the process and how you're feeling about it.
Yeah, I've learned so much in the process of working on this book, and I'm learning so much even right now as we're in this conversation, as these conversations continue. So I think in many ways, the publication of a book, maybe sometimes we think of it as an ending, but for me, it's much more the beginning. It's this invitation into conversation, and so much wisdom has come to me from really generous people as a result of that invitation, even just in the last couple of months. And I think one of the biggest things I've learned is the importance of taking leadership from Indigenous communities and communities of color if we really want to regenerate land in ways that tackle climate change and also at the same time really do tackle the legacy of colonization. And we can't tackle climate change without addressing the legacy of colonization. And whoever you are and however you relate to colonization, however you experience it in your daily life, whether you're on the front lines or not, whether you have some privilege that's come of it or not, ultimately that healing that we need for the land and for ourselves has to come from healing those processes of colonization. And there are so many Indigenous communities and communities of color who've been working to heal those processes of colonization as they show up in their own communities and in their own lands. And so for somebody like me, who comes from a settler colonial background, who's a white person, I think my role is to listen and to see how I can be of support. A, because that's really important from an equity perspective, but also I think it's really important to emphasize B, I'm thinking about this really influential quote about how our liberation is tied up with one another. That's actually from an Aboriginal Australian activist. And so if you're a white person, it's not an act of charity or generosity to support these efforts within Indigenous communities and communities of color. It's our liberation bound up in all of this, because that extractive agriculture that was set off by these processes of colonization, ultimately it's come for white people's family farms. Ultimately, it came for my family's farm that, you know, my grandmother lost in the Dust Bowl. That extraction, ultimately, it's harmful to all life. And so it is really, really important as we see ourselves in the face of an existential challenge like climate change to see also this leadership that's been there from all these Indigenous peoples, communities of color that have survived colonization to this point and have resisted and have continually shown a path to healing. It's really time for all of us, you know, to follow on that path of healing.
Okay, I'm asking for help in thinking about or talking about things that are hard to think about or talk about for me. Of course, we need to listen to one another, and that men especially need to listen to women, and white people especially need to listen to people of color, and so on. And there's this way in which, in reading Healing Grounds and in thinking in the last few months, there's this message that's been nibbling at me for a while, and which is, of course, something that people close to the land, Indigenous people, but farmers have known forever, or many have known forever, and that's that we also need to listen to other animals, and we need to listen to the land itself. And, you know, I feel dumb or ignorant in saying that, because it's not in my soul, I can say. And yet, it tracks. So help me think about this.
I guess in a perspective that I look at it is the changes that I'm practicing today or implementing today, even on my own family ranch, isn't necessarily what I'm doing for myself, but it's something that my children's children will benefit from. And bringing that back, and so when we talk about regen, when you guys kept saying that word, I was like, you know, like, it's like a new generation of thinking. And when we bring this back, because with words, you can manipulate words in the meaning. And so for me, you know, looking at it, like for my people, you know, talking about, you know, people of different color and different backgrounds, well, we have a medicine wheel. and it's circular like the earth, and it's split in four, and it has red, white, black, and yellow, and that symbolizes all the people of the earth. And then there's different meanings for life, and how after, you know, we pass, there's life within that because we go back into a system. And so listening to all these conversations, they're really about systems, and all systems are interconnected. And so, you know, looking at it through those perspectives, I feel like is really important. And looking at, yeah, regenerative agriculture is not going to save everything, but looking at how these systems interconnect to other things and how, you know, small changes could be implemented from, you know, what's being learned and what's being shared, I feel like is really one of the stronger suits of, you know, Liz giving us an opportunity to share our voices, because prior to, we weren't at the table, and then we got at this, a seat at the table, but we weren't really able to speak in a lot in terms. And now we have these platforms where we're able to speak and share and come at it where people have more of an open mindedness compared to, you know, looking at when you look back. And so, you know, when you look at history, if you break it down, it's, you could break it down to his story, and whoever's telling their story is how it's going to be written and saw and seen and viewed. And so, you know, that's when I got excited. I was like, you know, revamp this new generation. And so for me, I'm always finding ways of like, you know, how can we incorporate that into the knowledge base and the cultures of people of color that we already have, and share, you know, what is, you know, we're able to share, because there's some things in our cultures that, you know, are cultural sensitive that we aren't able to share unless it's amongst with our own, because, you know, whether it's tied to our ceremonies or our cultural practices, you know, that binds us to who we are as a people. And so just really looking at it from those perspectives, I think is really important.
Thank you for that. Maya, I have a feeling you, go ahead.
Oh, I also just wanted to clarify your question. Was your question, what are ideas of ways that you could be more connected to other beings?
Yeah, how do I listen, or how do I hear that? Where's that awareness come from?
Yeah. I mean, I think that you're kind of primed for it, right? Like you think a lot about food and where it comes from. And certainly there is the social history. It's, and then there's the biological history, but not just of the plant. But yeah, I think, you know, so before we eat, in our Buddhist practice, we take a moment to give thanks to the earth, to the animals. And it's this kind of pause to kind of look at our food and to, you know, in the parlance of now, it's like to think about where it came from, right? But really deeply, of, well, if I'm looking at this fig and there were wasps that were involved, right, in the process of creating that fig fruit. And so, like, what was it like for that wasp to lay eggs inside this fig? Whatever. Maybe that's not a route that people want to take, because it can seem kind of disgusting when you think about
it. Sounds great. It's just like getting all romantic thinking about it. It's really a cool thought.
Right. So any number of plants, right? There was some pollinator, and you think about the journey of that pollinator, where it's lived, what habitats made it possible for it to live there, its interactions with others. And so, you know, I think that, your very keen interest in food, understatement, you know, I think can already leads you down that path. It already opens a door for thinking about that whole ecosystem that made it come to be. And the way that too, I think in terms of how people might connect food to listening, not just to other beings, but also to understanding our history and the needs for repair, right? When we come to think about the lands that this food is grown on, that it really requires the thousands of years of stewardship that had happened by Indigenous peoples. And I think about that when you know, I go to grain conferences and hear about these fifth generation wheat farmers who say they've never added anything to their fields, but they rip every few years to bring up the nutrients. And I'm like, well, if you ripped, those nutrients came from people who really took care of that land, you know, all those generations before. So I think there are so many different points in our days when we can think about what made it possible for us to be here now, and not just other humans, but yeah, also other beings.
This has been really great, and I appreciate your time and your patience and your wisdom, and congratulations on this, because it's a great project. But now my last question, which we ask everyone, is what did you have for dinner last night? Whoever wants to start. Latrice?
Sure. This got brought up when I was with Liz last time. It was like a food. And I kind of showed up late because I was having dinner with my niece. And so my favorite food is steak. Like I'm inherently like, I love steak, whether it's buffalo or cow. And so for me, like, steak is my favorite food. And, you know, I really think about the sacrifice of the animal had to give their life to sustain mine, and in that relationship of giving and understanding. But also, you know, food is important too, because it brings you together. It brings people together, you know, to share conversation, you know, and to, you know, just connect. And so, you know, even this book is about that connection. And so, you know, I'm going to end it there. But for me, that's, you know, a steak.
My?
Oh, I had a like a soba noodle broth soup with CSA shiitake mushrooms and ginger that I grew, and also miso that I had made. It's 3-year-old miso from soybeans that I had made, and the koji is from Koda Farms.
That's now I'm impressed.
the miso, yeah. It's the thing when you make it though is that. You can't just make a small batch. So I've got about 3 gallons of miso that I'm trying to eat through. And so the fact that it's 3 years old is really mostly just happenstance, because it's taken me that long to try to eat through all of this miso. So yeah, just trying to plow through those jars every day.
I'm a big Koda Farms fan myself. That sounds great. Liz?
I actually had a thali from an Indian restaurant that I really love in California. And there were multiple kinds of lentils, all really delicious. And, you know, to the conversation we were having earlier, I think lentils were the first plant that I connected to as a teacher, and realizing that their way of sharing something and leaving something behind in the earth, that nitrogen that they had synthesized, that they would use some for their own growth, but then they would leave some behind for the next plant. Talking with farmers about witnessing that process and then reflecting on that process, it's just never left me, that sort of lesson of lentils. And I also find them incredibly delicious.
Right. You also wrote a great book about lentil farmers, it should be said. I think we're done. Thank you. It was so great. And, we'll be in touch. Congrats. And I do appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mark. Likewise. Thanks for spending all this time with us.
Yeah. Thanks for spending time with us. Thanks for your questions.
Yep. Thank you, Mark.
Bye.
Bye.
See y'all soon.
Wow. Well, we try to keep interviews relatively short, but with 3 such great guests, it was tough. Anyway, I really enjoyed myself. I'm sure you could tell. After we spoke, Farmer Mai was kind enough to send me a couple of bags of wheat that they'd grown. Beautiful stuff, both berries and flour. I've made bread and salads with it already. And in honor of that, I thought I would read for you our recipe for wheat berry salad with cabbage and mustard. You could use any whole grain in this, and you can use almost any cabbage, but this is awesome with wheat and Savoy cabbage. So the ingredients are 1 pound or so of cabbage, 1/3 cup of olive oil, or you could use some more, 2 tablespoons of whole grain mustard. Again, you could use more, and it doesn't have to be whole grain mustard, but that grainy stuff is great in this. 2 tablespoons of vinegar, sherry vinegar, cider vinegar, white wine vinegar, or to taste on that also. A lot of this is to taste. 1 small red onion, very thinly sliced, peeled and thinly sliced. And 2 cups of cooked wheat berries. So start with a little bit less than 1 cup and cook them until they're done. Then trim the cabbage as you need to and grate it by hand or in a food processor. This should be about 4 cups. And then make a dressing of that 1/3 cup of oil, 2 tablespoons of mustard, 2 tablespoons of vinegar, salt and pepper. Whisk that together. It's really good with a lot of pepper. It's nice with an immersion blender or if you whisk it very well so that it's creamy. And then separate the slices of onions and sprinkle them into the dressing and stir until that's well coated. Then toss the whole thing together, the cabbage, the wheat berries, and the dressing. Taste and adjust seasoning for that. Then serve right away, or you can cover it and refrigerate it for up to a day. Enjoy that. I want to thank, of course, the totally cool Liz Carlisle, Mai Nguyen, and Latrice Totsie. You can find Liz on Twitter at Liz Carlisle, at LizCarlisle. And Healing Grounds is out now. Great book. Check it out. Thank you for listening. Love to hear from you. food@markbittman.com. We will talk with you next week when we will be joined by someone or maybe some two awesome people. Take care. Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the Multi-Terrain Select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.